little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
As I explained in the preface to our last episode, a surgical procedure has left me with an impaired voice. And although it's slowly getting better, that and other events in my life have left me not to be able to continue doing this show. So in this last episode of Thinking Clearly, Julia and I will be sharing our thoughts and feelings about what this almost 10-year project has meant to us as we summarize some of the main themes that have emerged from our focus on critical thinking. And I encourage our listeners, and especially if you're a new listener, to use our podcast archive at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com to continue listening to, downloading, and enjoying any or all of the 114 episodes of Thinking Clearly.
Well, Bob, it has been a wild ride going on nearly 10 years now, but it has been a real blast, and I'm so fortunate that we've been able to do this project together. And I do encourage folks to check out our archive at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com. We'll be leaving up shows for a bit.
I've done some thinking about critical thinking over the span of time that we've done this show. And in my mind, some themes have emerged during our exploration of that topic. I think about our working definition, for example, of critical thinking, as well as the longer description, which emphasizes the mindsets, attitude, and convictions that we see being associated with critical thinking. Well, that first part, the working definition, goes like this.
Critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and belief.
One of the other big things that we try to do on this show over the years is to give resources, because we just introduce topics, touch on them. It's kind of the tip of the iceberg. And then we're hoping that folks who are serious about critical thinking will look at the submerged parts by employing some of the resources that we offer up. Two of the resources for logical reasoning. The first one is one of my favorite books. And by the way, the authors in both of these books we've had as guests. The book is just called A Concise Introduction to Logic by Patrick Hurley. The other book that's important to me was by Brooke Moore and Richard Parker. And that's a book called Critical Thinking. Both of those books are ones that we recommend that you look into. You can take a course. You could go to a community college and take a logic course or a critical thinking course. But it's very key, if you're going to be a critical thinker, to get a good handle on. You don't have to get into all the details of logic and symbolic logic, and you can get lost in the weeds in that, but to get the basic ideas and principles of logical reasoning is critical and important. Another theme is that there is a difference in terms of issues, and that difference is that some of them are descriptive issues. They're issues that describe reality, that describe what's really out there, deal with facts and observations and explanations about the world. And those are called descriptive arguments. And that's as opposed to arguments that have to go through our moral, ethical values wiring in our brain and have to do with what we like and don't like. They're very different arguments. We use the logic and the principles of logic to argue those and to come to our claims and conclusions, but they're quite different. For example, the Earth has the shape of a sphere and orbits the sun, a fact that we can support with a great deal of evidence.
So that's what would be considered a descriptive argument?
A descriptive argument. Either the Earth is spherical or it's not spherical. It's not an exact sphere. I mean, it bulges in the middle and a little depressed on the poles, but it's spherical. It's not a flat circular disk with a North Pole at the center and a wall of ice around it. There's a great deal of evidence that the Earth is a sphere. We have to look at the evidence. Is the evidence relevant? In other words, does it pertain to and logically somehow connect with our conclusion that the Earth is spherical? And how much evidence is there? So if we're comparing and contrasting a flat Earth with a spherical Earth, then we go ahead and do that. Now, people have come to the conclusion that the Earth is flat. So people who came to that conclusion have not understood the evidence, the overwhelmingness of the evidence that the Earth is spherical, and have distorted reality. You know, they've come to a conclusion that is false, that's not true.
There was a time when people believed that the Earth did not go around the sun, for instance, as we know and understand today. Does that mean that they were making something other than a descriptive argument at that time?
They had some evidence. They had their models during those times before we understood and came to the conclusion through evidence that the Earth moves around the sun in an orbit. But science changes. And the idea that the Earth was the center of the universe, there's some kind of intuitive idea, right? Because you see the planets and the stars moving around. It's almost as if they were.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very good point. I see the sun move. I see the moon move. I'm not moving. Sure. I'm right where I've always been.
That's true. And so people not only had religious ideas coming from the Christian Bibles, Old Testament, New Testament, that the Earth was the center of the universe and people were God's creation and got center stage for that reason. So there was evidence, but science, the strength of science is that it may look like something at one time, but that's not the end of collecting evidence, and it's not the end of coming to conclusions. Science is constantly changing. Descriptive arguments are ones that oftentimes have to do with scientific observations, systematic observations. Not always. Oftentimes they do. And that's in contrast to normative arguments, which deal with values and judgment. For example, I might say the death penalty, no matter what the crime, should be eliminated. Make that claim. So that's a normative. The universe is not saying anything about death penalties. Those are legal arguments. Use legal reasoning to come to those conclusions. They're ethical, moral arguments. I think what I'm saying here is that a very important thing to do from the onset, if you're tackling an issue and you're looking for evidence in the issue and you're trying to be a critical thinker, is to see what part of that is a normative argument and what part is a descriptive argument. Because often the issues are mixed. There's a descriptive part and there's a normative part.
I was going to say, I mean, it's pretty common, I think, for those things to maybe be muddled together a little bit. For instance, I could say smoking increases the risk of cancer, but it's also gross. Is there a distinction there? And is it an important distinction?
Well, when you say it's gross, that's the normative part, right? That pertains to your likes or dislikes. But there is a descriptive part too, because the evidence to see whether smoking increases the rate of cancer, you can do experiments to verify that. So there's a method for doing that. But when you say it's gross, how do you actually make that argument? What do you do to make an argument that something is gross? My point with this is that descriptive arguments, in my way of understanding them, are a lot more clear on what evidence that you'd use and how you'd reason from that evidence than normative arguments. Normative arguments, do you use a consequentialist argument, meaning smoking or the death penalty, whatever it is? How does that affect people in the long run? What are the consequences of that? And then weigh the consequences, advantages versus the disadvantage. So it's kind of a cost-benefit argument. But it's not as clear as to how to proceed with a normative argument, in my mind. But it's important and easy, fairly easy, to understand the different parts of an argument and which are saying something that's descriptive, is factually based, and what is pertaining mainly to our values. We've done a number of episodes talking about this. We did a whole episode on, in California, it was called Senate Bill 277. This is back in 2015. That Senate bill in California removed parental personal belief exemptions to vaccination requirements. In other words, if the parents thought for some reason like it was against their religion or didn't fit into their philosophy, they could keep their children from being vaccinated and still send them to public school. This bill was a bill to take away that option from parents so that you didn't have the personal belief option anymore. A child that could not be vaccinated for one reason or another and got a doctor's authorization for that could still have exemptions under this bill. But just saying that it's against my religion or I don't believe in vaccinations, I believe everything should be natural, that law took that away. And that has both descriptive and normative parts. The descriptive part is, are vaccinations safe and effective? You can do studies to that, and there's good evidence that the vaccinations that have been approved by the FDA are safe and effective. They go through a systematic number of different tests and studies. And the other thing that was trying to be proved that's descriptive is there such a thing as herd immunity? And does herd immunity actually protect folks? Once you vaccinate enough people, it puts a layer of protection over the whole population of people that are subject to those vaccinations.
Those are things that have been studied by scientists and public health experts, and there's documentation to, you know, look at that stuff. And though, you know, like any science could be updated upon more information, but it's based on the measurable kind of information that we have now is my understanding.
Yes. But the normative part is tricky. I had to look at that a few times to really figure out what is the normative part here? What would be the arguments for the normative part? And we concluded that the normative part was really who gets to decide, because the bill in California Senate gave the right to decide to the state, because public schools have a responsibility to keep children safe. So the argument there is that the state has not only a right, but a responsibility to engage in practices that are going to keep that child and other children in the school setting safe. And parents who objected to that said, those are my children. I'm their parent. I should have the right and responsibility to do what I think is in my child's best interest. So that's where the normative part, the values base, comes in. It's tricky, actually, constructing arguments for that issue, the normative parts of that issue. But it's important too. So some people, when they argue the issue, they try to argue it from the side of, well, look, vaccines don't work. There's more problems with giving vaccines than they actually cure. And that goes against the evidence. And I think that one of the reasons that people take that approach is they don't know how to handle, they don't know how to deal with the evidence that would show that parents should have the final say rather than the state.
And I've certainly heard some people say that it's not 100% safe. Of course, there's a difference between something being safe and being 100%. And, you know, that's where we get into something we've talked about on occasion is risk assessment. We take risks in leaving our house or not leaving our house or in the water we drink. And, you know, those are all assessed risks. It's not black and white, you know. So I think that's something also that I've heard anyhow from folks. And, you know, also it's important to understand where people are coming from, whether or not you agree with them, especially if you don't agree with them, to have a compassionate and empathetic ear to where people are even coming from so we can have a meeting of minds if that's your goal.
Yeah, very well said. So let's move on to the next idea here. That being how to vet information for relevance and accuracy.
Oh boy.
We're not going to say much about that because we did 3 episodes on that, 50, 51, and 52. And we developed like a 1-page handout sheet, if you want to call it that, on vetting strategies. So we're not going to go over all the details, but if you want to check that out, you can go back to 50, 51, and 52. It's literacy, it's information literacy, really, is how do we make sure as we can that our information is accurate? Boy, things have changed considerably since we started this.
And they're going to continue to.
They're going to continue to.
A word that has often come up on our show is curiosity. And to encourage people to have a scout mindset, to be curious. And I think this is one of those, especially because it is getting very difficult, especially with the prevalence of AI now, the internet just becoming a very complicated place, that it's more important than ever to be curious about new sources of information, or sources of new information, I should say. It's also where we're very susceptible to confirmation bias. We see something that agrees with our preconceived ideas and we want to run with it. But there's also more, in my opinion, more than ever, people trying to feed us information that we do or don't agree with in order to further their agenda. And so coming at things with a curious mindset, where did that information come from? Why is it, you know, being proliferated by this source and that sort of thing is really more important than ever because we're in a very, very messy, complicated information ecosystem right now.
And these themes all kind of intertwine. That's another theme, curiosity. We spend a lot of time talking about that. Episode number 59, we called it Deep Questions About Critical Thinking. And then 98, we had a guest, Jacqueline Gottlieb. And that we called The Nature of Curiosity and Its Implications for Critical Thinking. So, yes, and we've had many, many other episodes where curiosity came into the picture, again, even in civil dialogues. And we'll talk a little bit about that coming up.
I feel like one reason I emphasize curiosity is it is something that can make critical thinking at times feel like a chore into something that feels fun or interesting.
Yeah.
And it's something that, you know, we should never lose touch of.
Yeah.
Curiosity within ourselves.
It's powerful. There's a difference in your mind when you're saying to yourself, I really want to know what's happening here. I want to know what the most accurate answer to this is, instead of, I want to know what I can say that's going to prove my point or be a talking point for those groups I identify with. It's a real, real different feeling, you know, and I've had personal experiences with this where I switched into the mode of debate. And I was debating, I was trying to show off my knowledge of something and prove that I was right. And then I thought about it later that wasn't very fun. You know, what's really happening here? Maybe I'm not right on the mark completely. Maybe I'm missing some points. So shifting into the idea of working together with someone else, even though you have different ideas, different points of view, different opinions, working together with somebody else where you both get into the mode of, let's see what we can really find out about this rather than try to convince the other person. That's another theme that's come out of our show. The other thing I was thinking about in terms of themes is that we've talked a lot about is identifying our cognitive vulnerabilities. Now, in the sense of we've talked about and used these words before, heuristics and biases and the dual process framework. What book would you suggest for that if we were going to suggest a book?
Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. Is that a trick question?
No, it's not a trick at all. It's the right answer, though. Yeah, Daniel Kahneman. We talked a lot about him. He passed away, I don't know, a year ago or so. And I said on one of our episodes that he's one of the people I think we could have got on this show. I think he would have come on the show, and I would have loved to have him on. He was a gentleman. He was not only a person who got the Nobel Prize in economics for helping us figure out what we already knew, which is people are not ideal. They're not when they make economic decisions about something, it's not just what's going to be best for them in a descriptive sort of way. There's a lot of biases. There's a lot of under-the-hood cognition that goes on to affect our decision-making and our value judgments even. And we've talked in a number of different episodes about that. But what do these words mean? Heuristic. Heuristic's a rule of thumb, right? It's a mental shortcut that we have developed early on in our evolutionary development. And it can help us solve a problem in a lot of situations or make a judgment, make a decision. Can you think of an example of a heuristic that would really be helpful for us? No. All right. So let me see if I can think of an example. The traditional one is kind of old news, but you're walking through the jungle as a prehistoric person, and you're walking through the jungle and you hear some noise in the bush. That could be a predator, or it could be prey you've been looking for out hunting. You have to make a snap decision, though, because if that was a predator, a saber-toothed tiger or whatever, you'd be toast or dessert. And so it's important and it's evolutionarily sound and good that we have the ability to make these snap judgments, to assess not all the evidence, but enough evidence so that we will make a choice that is beneficial to us. So it's the best policy to take caution and either hide or run or avoid a possible predator. We can't sit around and think about, I haven't seen any predators on this trail for a long time. You know, you want to make some quick snap judgment. And that's the thinking fast part of Kahneman's title. That's a heuristic. The heuristic is, in this case, we've seen predators and heard predators in the bush before and had them jump out or had them threaten us in some way. So that rule of thumb of hearing certain sounds, twigs, crack, meaning that there was something weighty that broke those twigs, and we make the judgment. So that's a heuristic. But the thing about heuristics is that there's a time and a place to use them that is going to solve the problem for us or make the best decision or judgment about something. A bias is a heuristic being used and applied outside the conditions for which it's reliable and has developed the possibility of having a systemic error being produced and it leads to a bias. So my favorite example is if we had to go 1,200 miles to another state, We had to get there. Didn't matter whether we drove or flew. Our main concern was safety. We wanted to get there safely. And just before we made that decision of which way to go, because we could have gone either way, we see a horrific airplane accident with a lot of people that died. And so we decided, I'm going to drive. That is an example of using a heuristic. The heuristic is what's called availability. It comes to our mind, pops in our mind. This vivid graphic picture of this airline accident. But it also led to the bias that we could have avoided by actually checking out the statistics. If you don't know the statistics, very easy to see that airline travel is a lot safer than car travel.
Car accidents are so common, and injury and death because of automobiles is so common that it doesn't make the news.
That's
all the news would be.
Exactly. So this is the idea of the relationship between heuristics and biases. And the dual process model of putting this in perspective is that there's two, it's called system one and system two. Now, these are not pathways. You can't say system one has certain pathways in the brain, system two has. Although I've looked up the neuroscience, and there is some evidence that when people use system one, which is this intuitive, snap judgment, gut feeling approach to making decisions, is not checked in certain situations by system two. System two is the slower analytical way of making judgments and making decisions. Whereas system one is quick, doesn't use a lot of brain power. System two takes more resources. It takes us more time. It's more deliberate, more analytical. So it uses more energy, and it relies on cultural tools like looking at data, understanding statistics, doing a cost-benefit analysis. So there's a time and a place, the way I look at it, for system two types of approaches. And I think that what happens is a lot of people don't recognize that they're making a snap judgment, an intuitive decision. They say, well, it just came from the gut, okay? Well, the gut can be wrong. That's a bias, you know, in those situations where the gut is wrong. So there's a time and a place for those quick decisions, intuitive approach, and there's a time and a place to take your time with a decision, look at the facts, use whatever tools that you have to make sure that the result is good for
you. Seems like both have served us as a species.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I got to thinking about, well, how do we know that there's not brain paths, certain neural networks in human brains that are more the analytical and others that are more the system one, the intuitive. And so I looked up a little bit of that, and there is some developing evidence that using what they call functional MRI and the EEG, electroencephalogram, what they call TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, that they are developing and using and looking just for that very thing. But I remember Daniel Kahneman saying, no, don't, at the time that he wrote the book, saying, I don't mean this as neural pathways, but it has to be somewhere, right? It gets down to that. We make our decisions based on our neurology and our brain.
Well, he was trying to describe sort of an observable phenomenon, but as an economist didn't really, you know, dive into the neurology of mapping it, but I'm sure much of that is to come.
Yeah.
And I think also by identifying these different ways of thinking, we can also hone them in to develop the precision of these systems, you know, much like thinking slow and critical thinking is something that we're not necessarily born being great at. It's something that we can improve through a lot of the resources we share and, you know, ideas and thinking of other people, but also with the thinking fast system is something that can be honed in. You know, I think at one point we talked about firefighters. They're right. People who spend a lot of time training. And so they've really honed in their instincts, their fast thinking when it comes to, well, fighting fires and saving lives. Thank you, firemen.
Gary Klein is the person that we had as a two-time guest talking about the virtues of expertise and conditions under which you have to develop your intuition. That intuition can be trained. It's not just waiting for the universe to speak to you somehow. It can be trained, and that there's a value in that. And the cool thing for me, too, is that they did a paper together. They were coming from completely different angles, but Daniel Kahneman and Gary Klein did a paper, a major paper, together, doing exactly what we're talking about, is being curious about what we agree about and what we don't agree about and why. You know, trying to pin it down. And that's such a wonderful thing to happen in science, because sometimes scientists are adversaries and they get very nasty with each other, taking shots at each other, each other's findings or each other's theories. And in a way, that can be a virtue in science, because it puts your ideas and thought and experiments out there to be scrutinized by other people who may be skeptical of your approach. And it's good, but it's also good to join together. And so I think Kahneman and Klein kind of set the stage for that. There's a lot of what you call wars in science, where people are just coming from completely different ways of thinking, and they would never do what Kahneman and Klein does. So that's another reason that I really admired Daniel Kahneman. And I call him Daniel because we didn't get to talk to him in person. People who talk to him in person call him Danny, but I don't think I have the right to call him Danny because I don't know him. I just know of him.
It's a thought. Maybe we could do a reunion show with Daniel Kahneman on the Ouija board. Just saying.
All right. Well, I'm not going to comment on that suggestion.
Something to consider.
Yeah. I considered it. And I'm moving on. The other idea that we have talked about is the influence of group identification, the impact that has on our beliefs and behavior in this polarized, especially political atmosphere that we're living in. It looms its ugly head all the time.
And it doesn't have to be ugly. I think that's one of those things where we are social animals, and it's very much a part of who we are in our very being, is to be social animals, to have groupings of people to support each other. But it also, it has an ugly side, absolutely, with polarization, with demonizing other people and things like that. But to, I think, look at it as it is an inherent part of kind of who we are in our DNA. Mm-hmm.
I agree completely with what you said. And there's nothing wrong with affiliating with groups that have similar beliefs. But when it turns into a bubble where you don't listen to or expose yourself to other points of view, that's the negative. That's the downside, in my opinion. When you, like you said, demonize, start thinking of the other side politically as less than. They're not human anymore. They're failed, flawed people because they have different views than you. So I'm talking about the extremes of polarization.
Well, it's important to be able to see it. It's important to be able to see it because it can certainly cloud our perspective. It can cloud how we deal with each other, and to have some self-awareness about it. Something I've been doing lately is I really challenge myself when there's someone with such an extremely different point of view than I have, and I feel myself becoming angry or hateful or, any of these kind of like negative emotions about where this person's coming from, maybe because I perceive them as being hateful. I can't always do this, but I do try and challenge myself to consider where that person is coming from. Why do they see the world the way they do? Why do they see these other people the way they do? And where is that fracture? It's not going to solve everything, but it does break down the barriers. And most of all, I don't want to lose my humanity or the humanity or not be able to see the humanity in other people.
Yeah, we did touch on that subject, group identification. It's called cultural cognition or identity protective cognition. We protect our ideas and we protect our affiliation with a group by talking the company line. And we did that in number 35 with a guest whose name was John Gasto. Another one was interesting, episode number 56. It's called The Relationship of Group Identity to Critical Thinking with Amber Gaffney. So those were a couple that you could go back to if you're interested in those. And we're going to leave our archive up for as long as we can. Do you know? If a podcast stops and is no longer active, do they take them off?
No, we have total control over, I was going to talk to you about that afterwards, about the Libsyn.
Yeah. Okay. Because we do want to leave the episodes up as much as possible. It's interesting, too, to see us go through the development that we did when we first started.
Been a wild ride.
We were speaking a lot faster. That's what... I have slowed way down. And it was more spontaneous in some ways. And we were in a studio, too. And then the pandemic is what kind of broke that whole idea, and we started pre-recording our podcast. But it's interesting just to kind of see the changes that we've gone through and how these different themes began popping out of our episodes. Another one is an appreciation for expertise and how to identify true experts and when to rely on those experts. Because sometimes people come up with ideas and there's no consensus. They find an outlier, somebody who has a degree or whatever, but has a very outlying kind of opinion. Now, they may be right in the long run, but my odds are usually with consensus of experts. So that tells us what the field, whatever it is, psychology, sociology, science in some way, it tells us what the state of the literature on that particular subject is if we can somehow identify consensus of people who are experts. That's why I have so much appreciation for a lot of guests, because those are people who've invested a lot of time in their education of that thing that they are actively working at. They've done research, and many of them are experts in the field that we were talking about. But where this idea came back for me is I was reading the July-August 2025 edition of Skeptical Inquirer, and we've had a lot of guests that are associated with this skeptical movement one way or the other, or have done articles for the Skeptical Inquirer. And one of our first guests was Steve Novella. And he is the founder and big brother of the podcast
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, thanks. And he has, what, three brothers?
I don't know the head count. He does have brothers.
Yeah, that are part of that podcast. And so one of his brothers, Jay Novella, wrote an article in this July-August Skeptical Inquirer, and he talked about how his brother Steve founded that podcast and was the mentor for that very popular and noteworthy podcast, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And he said this. He said, Steve introduced us to the cornerstone of his own philosophy, that we must all accept the fact that there are massive gaps in our knowledge and understanding of most things. We should always defer to the experts and never overestimate our own capabilities. We need this humility to keep us honest with ourselves. So that's what got me thinking about experts, because we cannot understand all the details of a field that we've never had any training in. We have to rely on believing and putting some stock in people who are noted experts in that field. That is something that I think people sometimes say, well, experts, what do they know?
Well, the fact of the matter is we do it every day in our lives. When your car breaks down, you don't just like grab someone off the street and say, hey, fix my car. You go to someone who has an expertise, who's an auto mechanic. When you have a significant plumbing problem in your house or your computer won't start, you go and you find people who are trade experts in those things to fix them. I really come back to the analogy of something I don't do, which is work out at the gym. I'm decidedly not a bodybuilder. But our brain is like a muscle. You know, we've also touched on this before as well, that, you know, it takes, you know, with proper exercise, with some guidance of how to shore up this muscle and how to understand something. If I remember right, Steve Novelli's a neuroscientist, I think.
He's a doctor. He's a neurologist.
Neurologist, that's right. You know, I if it comes down to me or him having brain, like performing brain surgery, you know, I think I know who I'm going to prefer, because that's where the training is. And, you know, again, yes, you know, as we touched on at the beginning of this episode, science changes. Science evolves as new information is presented. And that is true for the experts of areas, you know, that they will learn things too, and they will upgrade their expertise. But they are the ones who spend the time and the effort to be experts at a particular thing. And they are the bodybuilders of that topic. And I think that's something worth acknowledging the value of.
Definitely. The other thing is, and this kind of relates to that, is the importance of science literacy and basic literacy in the content areas relating to the issues we are examining. This is one of those additional mindsets that we have identified and used in our description of critical thinking, is that if you're going to tackle an issue that you don't know anything about, you need to do the background, just like a journalist does. If a journalist is going to write an article, they do background. They look into it. They get to a point where they have enough knowledge about what's happening with that particular issue to make judgments when they talk to people that they interview. So that's really important. And I want to talk about AI before we get done with this episode, but I've been using AI to help me do that background and been very satisfied with the way it works, but I don't want to get off on that quite yet. But what I was thinking about when I thought about this is, I was thinking about, why do people tend to, and things that they don't know about, and believe me, there's an illusion of knowledge. We did a whole episode on that. This comes up all the time when you're talking to people and they ask you questions, right? Happens to me all the time. They ask me a question about something I've been talking about, and I realize, well, I don't know. I really don't know. Give me a break, okay? I'll go look this up. And it happens a lot. We have an illusion that we know a lot more about things until somebody starts asking us good questions, and then we realize how little we know about it. But I was thinking about this, and I call it my black box idea. I was trying to think, why is it that people grasp what seems to be simple answers, or even go back in history as to the way before science developed and explained something? There are people that believe that germ theory is wrong, that germs don't cause these diseases at all.
And I mean, I can't see it.
Exactly. You can't see it, but we have access to microscopes. Yeah,
I don't know how microscopes work.
I know. I could kind of tell you, but and now you get into electron microscopes, you know, not just optical microscopes, but we have electron microscopes that can see even smaller things. And then quantum type microscopes that can even see smaller. And then the Hadron Collider, for example, is not like a microscope that you're going to see something, but you can investigate things that are very, very small. So we've developed technology that will allow us and extend our senses with these things. But I want to get back to this black box idea, because I was thinking, why is it that some people, even though they don't know anything about it, they will tend to believe something that I know is not true, because I have a science background and I know just enough about it anyway, even though I'm not an expert, to know, no, that couldn't work. There's a lot of quantum woo, meaning that just because there's quantum behavior that we've observed, that opens the door to all the psychic phenomena that people believe in.
Stuff sounds pretty trippy to me.
So getting back to this black box idea is that what I think has happened is that science has become so detailed and complex in many ways. That's the quantum world. It's just, it's an affront to our intuition. How can something be in more than one place at one time? And how can there not be answers to what caused this to happen other than, well, it's statistically going to happen at this rate with no reason. Radioactivity.
I'm still baffled by a wave-particle duality. That sounds pretty made up to me.
Exactly. That's what's happened is that as we look closer and closer to the world we live in, scientifically, the things that we thought were simple answers, intuitive answers, because we don't live in the microscopic world. We live in a macroscopic world. And we're baffled by the idea that it could be that complex and anti-intuitive. Get back to this idea of, well, there's a black box. I don't know the workings of that black box. You have an input and an output. And I think that what's happening is that there's too much distance. People are removed from science and from the details of science, and they throw up their hands and say, I want a simple answer. I want a way I can understand this. So it's a black box idea. I don't have to understand what's going on in the black box. I just have to understand here's the input and here's the output. So I don't have to understand how psychic phenomena work. They're beyond reasoning anyway. Science can't investigate them. I mean, it can try to investigate the phenomena and see if they're real, but it can't come up with an explanation about how something breaks the laws of physics. And so they have this distance that's occurring. I read a lot of science, Scientific American and Nature, things like that. And the intricacy with which investigators, scientists are understanding even biological processes, complex minutiae of our immune system, for example, and how it works. It's mind-boggling. And even if you have some background in it, you know, scientists now specialize. They might be biologists, but they don't know everything about biology. They know something about the little subfield that they are actually specialists in. I think it's because there is so much known, so much knowledge that's been discovered about the way the complexity of things work in the world that people have just lost the ability or the desire to even try to wade into that.
I would take a step back maybe to a little bit more of maybe just a primitive mindset in that we've always had to do that, you know, as early as humans having fire. They didn't know what combustion was. They didn't know why combustion happened, but it did, and it served purpose. And then it became a really crucial part of who we are as a species. You know, how many cars are on the road in our country, and how many of those drivers could tell you why a car moves or how an engine works? you know, we're here connected on Zoom recording this radio show, and I couldn't tell you exactly how my Bluetooth mic works or bits travel through nodes on the internet and then get recorded digitally and broadcast through podcasts and FM. I know bits and parts of it, but I also think it's a kind of what we're tasked with in life is, you know, we have to, I don't know how my phone knows what time it is or why the alarm goes off other than I set it, you know? So it's, I think it's a little bit of an expectation of just how we have to move through the world. And I'll just bring it back to curiosity, why it's important to be kind of proactive, like, oh, wow, huh. I don't know how my non-manual, my CVT Subaru transmission works. It's a new thing. I know how old transmissions worked with gears and things like that, but it's something I could also maybe learn a little bit about. And also we are driven by narrative. A lot of what we learn in our life is through and around narratives. That's, I think, sometimes what we need to do is to construct a story to explain what it is we're seeing in the world, and that story may be on a spectrum of accuracy, but it gets us through the day.
Yeah, that's the black box thinking I was talking about, is we don't understand how that black box works, but I think the negative thing, and maybe I'm completely off base with this, but I think the negative part of that is that people throw up their hands and revert back to more primitive understandings of things. And there was a point in, you know, Greek mythology where if you didn't understand what happened in your life, it was the gods somehow interfering, directing human behavior, and cause and effect was the gods. That's what I'm talking about when I'm saying going back to the more sort of primitive ways, simple answers that are completely divorced, in my opinion, from the way the world really works. Well, we're getting to the end here. As I like to say, the sand is running out of our hourglass here. But the one thing I do want to leave us with is AI, artificial intelligence. Because other than being aware up to speed on the kind of political struggles that are happening in the U.S. and worldwide, I think it's very important to use critical thinking and learn as much as you can about AI. I'm hopeful that it will be used for good purposes, and it has a lot of good purposes, but as we've talked about before, there's a lot of downside, and it's important not to treat it as a black box. It's important to understand what it is, how it works, what we need to do to live with it, because it's coming. Not going to be stopped. I see no movement at all for even regulating, other than the EU, you know, and some other countries have regulated artificial intelligence. But right now, it's a all stops out race to further develop AI, especially between China and the United States. It's going to be coming. It's too easy to fall into the polarized opinion extremes in AI, because you don't know enough to have a grounded opinion of it. But I want to encourage listeners to understand AI, get into some of the details, not just the technology of how it works, but the economics of how it's going to be developed. That's a big aspect, and how it can affect lives. So that's about all we have time for in this particular final episode. I do want to say that in our various episodes of Thinking Clearly, that we've focused on introducing research, findings, concepts, ideas, and skills related to critical thinking, while also giving resources for continued learning and practice. And you can check out all our archive podcast versions. And my hope's always been to serve the listeners well in making better decisions in their lives, and also provide them with skills to help make a better world as we face those challenges ahead. And I think, in terms of my orientation, to use science and critical thinking to reveal what's out there, reveal reality accurately, and use philosophy and moral reasoning to help guide our values for a better world. And that's my summary.
Yeah. And just to, it's been said before, I'll say it again, our podcast will remain archived on the website, thinkingclearly.libsyn.com, LIBSYN.com. While we have dealt with some topical, timely topics, I think that the majority of our shows are quite perennial and can be appreciated well into the future. So I hope folks still find them useful. You can still open up your podcast app and add the feed, Thinking Clearly. There just aren't going to be any more new shows planned for adding to that feed, but you will still be able to find all of our shows there.
I do want to thank all of our guests for the time that they gave us. They've been very generous in giving us time, and they're experts in what they do. They've got a combined knowledge and wisdom and goodwill. So I want to thank them all as a group for being our guests on Thinking Clearly.
We've had some really special guests and some really amazing people that I've, for instance, we mentioned Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I've been listening to for quite some time, and they have over 1,000 shows. But all of our guests have been really amazing and have really contributed to what makes Thinking Clearly, in my opinion, pretty awesome.
Yeah, and our listeners. So we always want to thank our listeners for their interest and support. And lastly, and I have such a heartfelt, hearty thank you, Julia, for being an inspiration and a partner in this enterprise for all these years.
What a treasure. Thank you, Bob, so much for helping get this show up and going and being such an amazing, constant co-host through, I've been saying it's been 10 years for a while now, but I guess I'll just keep saying
it. It's close enough, we can say that. Almost 10 years. So to everyone, for the welfare of us all, please keep thinking
clearly.
Cozy chair. No one seems to question all the claims out on the air. Oh, I've had enough of the promises that are so tremulous. And I can't conceive the cast of creeps and cretins who continue to be so uncannily credulous. Everyone, don't believe what is said, but put your stock in what's done. Insist on all the facts, and then add up your own sum, or else the punch you might get won't be Hawaiian.